You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, June 8th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, international affairs professor at Johns Hopkins University, Henry Farrell, on the precarious nature of our democracy. Also on the program today, a new trove of IRS data published by ProPublica reveals billionaires pay less taxes as a percentage of their income than a worker making $45,000 a year here. 25 Republican states are about to end enhanced federal unemployment payments months early before they expire. The Biden-Capetto infrastructure talks near their end game. One might say their infrastructure is collapsing. Meanwhile, the Biden DOJ will continue to defend Donald Trump in his defamation lawsuit brought by an alleged sexual assault victim. Senate report claims the Capitol Police had intelligence on an armed insurrection 2 weeks before January 6th. The Justice Department says it has recovered most of the Colonial Pipeline ransom Bitcoin. Texas governor signs a bill to punish businesses to require proof who require proof of COVID-19 vaccination. The feds subpoena a Cuomo book materials in their nursing home deaths investigation. And socialist Pedro Castillo appears to have beaten right-wing Keiko Fujimori in the Peruvian presidential election. Although Fujimori is claiming now election fraud. Can't imagine where she got that idea. Lastly, SB 933 passes in the New York Senate, could radically change antitrust law in New York. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Happy Tuesday. Thank you for joining us. Joining me as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello, I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I am fine. I got to say, pretty excited about that. SB 933 passing in New York State. It changes, and it has to go to the Assembly, but there's every reason to believe that it would pass there. It changes. You know, we've talked about this on this program so many times. In the 1980s, under Ronald Reagan, at the behest of Robert Bork and the University of Chicago type folks, the definition of antitrust changed essentially to what they call a consumer welfare standard, which basically said, we're throwing out all the questions of whether something's anti-competitive. We're throwing out all the questions as to whether it is creating a consolidation of power that can influence our politics. We're cutting out all sorts of considerations other than if it has the potential to lower prices for consumers. A lot of times it turns out it doesn't, but there's a presumption that a monopoly would. And we've been working under that auspices for 40 years on a federal level. And if they change it in New York State to a question of being not just anti-competitive, but having too much power, just an assessment of too much power within a marketplace as defined by a certain amount of market share or other dynamics, It's going to hopefully influence, well, New York is a very important state for a lot of businesses, but it will hopefully influence what happens on a national level. So that's pretty exciting.
Very much so.
Yes. Thank you. And we'll talk about this later in the program, maybe in the second hour, but the Texas governor signing a bill that punishes corporations or businesses if they require in any way, you know, maybe not even to enter, but maybe like here, you know, like I've been to a bar in New York City where it's like there's a vaccinated section and an unvaccinated section. Everybody gets to go in. It's just that if you choose not to get a vaccination, you sit over there. But in Texas, now that's going to be illegal, which is really, if you spend like 30 seconds thinking about what is one of the fundamental supposed conservative values, which is that business owners can do what they want, right? To the point where many of these people would have or still even refer to their opposition to something like the Civil Rights Act, right? Which essentially they had a problem with because it constrains the private property of your business, right? They have a problem with the idea that you might be obligated to serve your gay customers in the same way that you would serve your...
I was going to say, they were all in favor of the business owner being able to make a decision about whether or not they'd bake a cake for a gay couple getting married. But now they're very concerned about the private business decisions about vaccinated / unvaccinated people.
Right. They're basically outlawing the ability of the business to make that assessment. And so I don't know, there's some question as how it's going to affect the cruises that leave from Texas, because I don't know, maybe they could do an all unvaxxed cruise.
Seems like they're really infringing on big businesses' right to self-determine. I don't know.
Yes. It would appear that way. But we may have more to discuss about that in the later in the program. But let's get to this clip. This is now we're facing quite a dilemma right now in terms of this country and in terms of our democracy. We're going to be talking to Professor Henry Farrell about that. It's all coming around the time where one of the key mechanisms to ensure that people have access to or the ability to vote and that our politics are not completely overrun by money and that we don't have one party redistricting in such a way that makes it virtually impossible for any type of democratic results to take place. And by democratic, I mean, you know, largely speaking, one person, one vote. And how that reflects in terms of their representation, that is all in the air. And apparently Anderson Cooper sat down with Barack Obama and here is Barack Obama, who I want to remind everybody said every 18 months of his presidency, almost like clockwork, if the Republicans win in the off-year election, the fever is going to break. And he would say, and if the Republicans lose, the fever is going to break. And he spent months and months and months, and wasted valuable time in trying to negotiate the ACA with them. He tried to, frankly, cut Social Security increases, cost of living increases. The Republicans, fortunately for a lot of us, were too in transit to say yes to him. But he still will not let go of this premise, and it is becoming very problematic, I would suggest. Here's that clip.
And the leadership of the GOP, briefly for one night when they still had the sort of scent of fear in them, going against the president.
And then, poof, suddenly everybody was back in line. Now, the reason for that is because the base believed it. The base believed it because this had been told to them not just by the president, but by the media that they watch. And nobody stood up and said, stop. This is enough. This is not true. I won't say nobody. Let me correct it. There were some very brave people who did their jobs, like the Secretary of State in Georgia, who was then viciously attacked for it. And all those congressmen started looking around and they said, you know what, I'll lose my job. I'll get voted out of office. Another way of saying this is I didn't expect that there would be so few people who would say, well, I don't mind losing my office because this is too important. America's too important.
Some things are more important than just...
Our democracy is too important. We didn't see that. Now, I'm still the hope and change guy. And so my hope is that the tides will turn. But that does require each of us to understand that this experiment in democracy is not self-executing. It doesn't happen just automatically. It happens because each successive generation says these values, these truths we hold self-evident. This is important. We're going to invest in it and sacrifice for it, and we'll stand up for it, even when it's not politically convenient.
What's so infuriating about this is that he clearly, and look, as a private individual, I don't care what Barack Obama does. Frankly, I mean, I have an opinion, but I don't care that much. But when he gets out there as the former president and reiterates the same thing he said throughout his entire two terms of presidency, that my hope is the tide will turn. These are not tides. Tides exist in nature, and the moon dictates the tides. His passivity and his notion that this is just going to happen in some way, the fever is going to break. And frankly, Joe Biden said the same thing. We are now at the 6-month point where he said the Republicans are going to come around. You watch, man. No joke. They're going to come around. This relentless belief that something's going to happen on its own. And he even says democracy is not self-executing. It is not automatic. Where is the proposal to do something beyond? My hope is that each of us understand. People don't just wake up one morning and go like, hey, wait a second. Maybe I shouldn't be so interested in my own power and instead just acquiesce to democracy. That's not the way it works.
He hedges in that too. This experiment in democracy is not self-executing, as he passively describes how essentially Republicans needing to abandon their careerism in order to hold truths as self-evident and believe in our democracy. That is a very passive admission that you believe that it should be self-executing. That's the exact definition of it. So he contradicts himself in that own statement. And he completely, and he did this throughout his presidency, as you mentioned, absolves himself of the responsibility that he has to move that needle, to push the democracy towards a more healthy area. And he continues to do so after he's left office, where I guess you would think maybe you could be more honest and have less obligations. But he's still the same guy in this area.
He is still exactly the same guy. And it's, you know, his opinion on the matter is irrelevant. What is far more relevant is a call to action, yet there is none. And we're going to talk in just a moment with Professor Henry Farrell. He is a professor of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University and also the Washington Post monkey cage editor in chief on that very question of what we need to do to salvage our precarious democracy. We'll be back in just a moment with Professor Farrell. In the meantime, a couple of sponsors of the program today. First off, are people heading back to the post office? One of the, you know, I'm slowly going to places, but And I'm actually going to more places than I normally would, because generally pre-pandemic, I didn't want to go anywhere. And now I'm going to get that out of my system. But the bottom line is, I don't know if people are still heading out to the post office. And certainly, hopefully they're not paying full price for postage, because thanks to stamps.com, you don't have to anymore. Stamps.com allows you to mail and ship anytime, anywhere, right from your computer. Send letters, ship packages, and pay a lot less with discounted rates from the U.S. Postal Service and UPS and more. Stamps.com saves businesses thousands of hours and tons of money every year. It is a must-have for any business, regardless of your size. Stamps.com, you use your computer. You can go on 24/7, 3 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon, 7 in the morning, 7 in the evening. I mean, it doesn't matter. I get people get the point of that. You can get postage for any type of letter, any type of package, any class of mail going anywhere you want to send it. Then all you do is you schedule a pickup or you drop it off. Stamps.com, you get discounts up to 40% off of post office rates and up to 66% of UPS shipping rates. 1 million or nearly 1 million small businesses already use Stamps.com. Incredibly convenient. And also saves you cash. What more would you want? Stop wasting time going to the post office and go to stamps.com instead. There's no risk. And with promo code Majority Report, you get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. There's no long-term commitments. There's no contracts. Just go to stamps.com. You click on the microphone at the top of the homepage. You type in Majority Report, the name of the show. Majority Report. That's stamps.com, promo code Majority Report. Stamps.com. Never leave your office or home again. Meanwhile, a lot of folks doing stuff for self-care. Very important right now. Everybody I know is like having almost as much time with the with like the lockdowns, with the sort of like end of lockdowns, as with the lockdowns themselves. It's difficult. You need to take a little you time, take care of yourself, make yourself feel good. And for folks who wear bras, Third Love's limited edition summer styles are designed with tropical inspired colors. They are vacation ready designs. They have breezy feelings that whisk you away to your own personal paradise. You can find your happy place with Third Love's perfectly fitted bras and quality sleepwear. Check out Third Love to find out your new favorite everyday essentials. They got their new feather lace collection. They've added it to their number one rated 24/7 classic t-shirt bra. And they have a simple fitting room quiz that factors in size, your breast shape, current fit issues, your personal style. It helps you find the perfect bras, the perfect underwear, all for you there. If you have any questions, they have fit stylists that are available for one-on-one chats. Their perfect fit promise means if you don't absolutely, positively love it, exchanges and returns are completely free. So far, Third Love has donated over 40 million gently used return bras to women in need. Support charities in their local San Francisco Bay Area and across the U.S. I am not a bra wearer. However, I do have a testimonial from one of our official bra wearers on the Majority Report. The idea that I had 60 days to try out the bras drew me in. But in the end, I don't think I've ever had a better experience buying clothing online. Certainly not when it comes to bras. The fit finder worked like a charm. The choice of styles, amazing. Both the bras I ordered were a perfect fit. They are incredibly comfortable and cute and subtle. I can tell you that my daughter has a couple of Third Love bras, and she is constantly asking if Third Love will send her free ones. And I'm like, no, why would they do that? And she's like, okay, I'm just asking. She loves the bras. You deserve some TLC. That's Third Love Comfort. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now. You get 20% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 20% off today. I want to make it clear, I do purchase my daughter clothes She gets a certain amount of cash. She can spend it the way that she wants. She, as you know, turns around and flips it all on Depop, and there it is. But she loves her third love, Roz, that's for sure. All right. Want to welcome back to the program Henry Farrell. He is the Stavros Nekros Foundation Agora Institute Professor of International Affairs at Johns Hopkins University, and the Washington Post Monkey Cage Editor-in-Chief. Henry, welcome back to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Will you please tell Emma how I mispronounced your intro?
Well, it's a Greek name, so it's a little hard, and it's something which it's one of these terribly complicated titles that I guess academics love, but that really don't mean very much in the real world. So it is Stavros Niarchos Foundation Agora Institute Professor, if I'm remembering right, and sometimes I don't remember either.
Well, I appreciate your correcting me.
And don't worry, it's not an issue of not remembering. He just can't do it to save his life.
I can't pronounce things. That's part of my hook. If you could move your camera over just a little bit too.
Yep. So we get hold on. Is this better? Yeah.
Oh yeah. Maybe actually go back the other way because I think we're getting a little light behind there. Okay, great. That's terrific. That's great right there.
Okay. Sorry. I didn't know this was a video thing. I would have dressed in something better than the t-shirt.
That's all right.
No, we're a casual program here.
We're a casual program. So you have, co-written with your colleague, Bruce, Schneer, a report on how to deal with the current crisis of democratic fragility in this country. Let's just start with the basic premise or the basic question, I guess, of what do we mean when we say democracy? And how much of that have we just generally had here anyways?
Okay, well, that's a really good question. And it's a really complicated set of debates as well, because, of course, political scientists and everybody else, it's very, very hard to arrive at a collective definition of what democracy is. So I think that one way to think about it is just think to try and strip it down to its basic elements, to get away from the notions of fairness, the notions that democracy ought to be something which is wonderful. And just to say, democracy is purely and simply a system in which when the government loses an election, it leaves office, where officials, when they lose elections, they recognize that they are no longer officials and they leave office. And from that, many of the other good things of democracy flow. And even on that minimalist definition, we obviously are in trouble in the United States. We are not in a situation anymore where it is clear that officials, even when they have lost fair and square, are going to be willing to leave office.
Okay, and so we presume that if the government is leaving when they lose, the incumbent government is leaving when they lose, that it presumes a free and fair election, because presumably the government would have the apparatus to make the election not free and fair. And so if they're the ones who are willing to, if the incumbent is willing to leave office peacefully, that is an indication, at the very least, as a bare minimum, democracy is, at least that's the bare minimum that we're talking about when we talk about democracy.
That's right. And I think that one of the things that Bruce and I are trying to argue in this piece is to say that when we think about democracy, democracy is made up in a very important way of mutually reinforcing expectations and beliefs. That is that I believe that if you lose office, that you are going to then acknowledge your defeat and you're going to step out. And you're, of course, going to plot to try and come back in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years or whenever it is. But nonetheless, that you will accept that you have lost the support of voters. And you believe the same thing about me. And as long as we both believe that about each other, democracy can be a self-reinforcing set of beliefs. But once we stop believing that about democracy, once we stop believing that the other side is going to leave, then suddenly a lot of those beliefs can unravel. And this is part of the reason that Bruce and I tried to write this piece, was to point in a sense to the ways in which these beliefs are fragile, these beliefs are important, and much of the worry that people are expressing, it's not just us. I also signed a letter with 100 far more distinguished experts on democracy than myself in the last week, which made much the same kinds of arguments. One of the big reasons why democracy is in such trouble in the United States is precisely because we don't have that kind of self-reinforcing set of beliefs, which serves as one of the foundation stones of democracy.
You know, we just played before you came on a clip of Barack Obama in an interview with Anderson Cooper, where he both said that democracy is not a self-generating, or maybe he said self-reinforcing. It's not automatic. But then he went on to basically just say, I'm paraphrasing and I'm maybe editorializing a little bit. With that said, I just hope that we all understand and that the tides will turn. And that is not, in my opinion, not terribly helpful. I mean, you've taken a stab here. It is not acknowledging that we're at that crisis where we have clearly a situation that is creating, that is chopping away at the foundation of that self-reinforcing mechanism.
Yes, that's right. And I think part of the problem, you know, there are a number of problems. First of all, the problem is trying to get people to the stage where they're aware that this is happening and that they're aware that this is a problem. And secondly, and I think that this is the much greater challenge at the moment, is getting people who are in support of democracy to start taking the necessary steps that they have to take in order to try and protect and defend it. And of course, this is part of the problem that we have seen with Joe Manchin over the last couple of days, is that it is one thing to say that we want to protect democracy. It is another thing to take politically potentially controversial steps in order to protect democracy when you have a party, the Republican Party, which is deliberately stepping out of its way in order to try and prevent some of these steps from being taken and in order to try and prevent basic reforms which would allow democracy to proceed along in a minimally stable fashion. So I think that's the situation that we're in. And I think that people like Obama, you really want to move on from the general hope that things are going to get better, to start thinking about the specific ways in which you can try to make things better. And this is not something where there are any very easy answers, but it is a huge challenge that confronts us all.
And I should say that, you know, people have been sounding the alarm that you outline in this piece for months, if not a couple of years, because of Donald Trump sort of functioning and the greater right-wing echo, media echo chamber, as it were, to undercut, you know, sort of like pre-undercut the legitimacy of the election, right? I mean, maybe he was doing that. I mean, he was actually doing it in retrospect of his 2016 election, talking about there were 3 million immigrants that, you know, went up to New Hampshire and voted, whatever it was. That was the beginning of him hacking away at this foundation. And then I want to get into specifically what you've said in the thing, but I just want to make sure that we hit this point that Joe Biden said during the campaign, probably about a year ago, almost a little more than a year ago, that, you know, 6 months after Donald Trump was gone, you'll see the Republicans are going to come around. It seems to me that Obama and Biden, more so Biden at this point, Obama can decide to just, you know, stay on vacation or wherever he wants to do. That they need to sort of like acknowledge that they were wrong and that their perspective on this was not just, you know, wasn't just to make a mistake and I'm surprised, but like going forward, they have to change that belief, right? Because that's the first step. I mean, talk about those, why people subscribe. You mentioned why people subscribe to democracy, but those beliefs have broken down and they must acknowledge that to move forward onto, you know, sort of how the feedback loops that you talk about get fixed.
I think that's right. But I'll qualify that a little bit, which is to say that we always want to have people publicly admit that they were wrong. when they indeed were wrong. And for me, I think that's a little less important than whether or not they take practical steps in order to act on the, okay, we are not in a situation where democracy is going to be a self-re-equilibrating process where we can just expect the system to return to normal, where Republican politicians are going to begin to embrace democracy once the immediate leadership of Trump disappears. If they start taking practical steps to try and counteract these tendencies, I think for me that is more important than having a situation where they publicly come out and say, actually, we were completely wrong about that. Because, of course, it's very difficult always for politicians to admit that they're completely wrong about something. But what I will say is something that you picked up on that I think is really important, which is that this was baked in the cake for a long time. And very plausibly in 2016, one of the most plausible understandings of all of the Russian social media efforts and releases of hacked information and so on. One of the very plausible ways to interpret this was that they were not trying effectively to help Trump win because they didn't think that that was possible. They agreed with everybody that Trump was going to lose, but instead they were trying to set things up for a situation like the situation we have now in which the election would be contested and you would have Trump saying that he was cheated out of a proper election victory. So if, for example, you see some of the things that Gotcha for 2.0, which was a hacking identity that was adopted by the Russian GRU, if you look at the ways in which that identity was communicating in the days around the election, it very clearly was looking to cast doubt upon the election results and to suggest that the Democratic National Committee had figured out a way to fake its way to a victory here. So I think that this is a problem that we could have been experiencing in a different way back in 2016, had however many tens of thousands of voters voted a different way. And it is a problem that we're going to have to confront systematically because it is a problem that is not going to go away. Once this begins, once the can of worms has been opened, they wriggle around the place and you can't get them back in. So you've got to figure out what kinds of damage control you can do.
I think that I share your assessment on what the intention was at that time. And one can only imagine, you know, as to the extent that there's any difficulty for the Republican Party saying that that Joe Biden is an illegitimate president, he shouldn't be elected. They would have had a much easier go of it with a woman as president, I think, based upon, you know, sort of like, you look at how much traction they got with Barack Obama in a very, you know, sound defeat with an opponent who was willing to concede that they lost. With Hillary Clinton, I think they would have had a field day in you know, not that they're not having a field day with it now. But I guess my point about the politicians admitting they were wrong is less, I'm not so concerned with them admitting that they're wrong, but part of Joe Biden, because when we start talking about, you know, what to deal, how to, and maybe I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves because I want to talk a little bit more about the actual material problems that you outline here. But if Joe Biden gets out there and says, maybe he doesn't have to say he's wrong, but if he says we have a crisis of democracy now, Joe Manchin is wrong. This is not about partisan. This is Joe Manchin's not going to be, if he's convinced, it's not going to be unless Joe Biden comes out there and says, hey, I'm seeing something different than I saw before, it seems to me. But before we get there, let's talk about sort of the how the consensus of the breaking down of the belief system, the shared belief system, that it's in our advantage to subscribe to democracy because it gives us an opportunity to win. How does that, how that has broken down over time? You talk about three different ways, democracy being weakened subtly through slow strangulation, a downward spiral reinforced by decaying trust in institutions of vote counting. And then the third spiral, you have to say that our opponents are reasonable as opposed to, like, I don't know, running pedophile rings out of pizza places.
That's right. And so here what we're doing is we're borrowing ideas from a political theorist and political scientist called Adam Shavorsky. And really his fundamental argument is this, that the thing that stabilizes democracy is uncertainty about who is going to win over the longer term. And so you want to, first of all, have that uncertainty there, that people know that if they lose this election, that they will have the opportunity to try and figure out ways to win again 2 or 4 years from now. And so you need to have that assuredness that people are going to leave office. You also want to be sure that the system is not rigged in ways that the voting is, you know, it is possible for you to win, that the votes are not rigged against you. That is also something which is key. And finally, as you say, you want to be sure that the people who are effectively your opponents, the people who are on the other side in whatever political fight you are engaged in, are not evil people who are demented and crazy and devoted to establishing the reign of Satan on earth or whatever other crazy thing you want to ascribe to them. And the problem that we identify is that all three of these things are very much, much more in doubt than they used to be. And we started writing this before, for example, the craziness in Arizona began, where we have this quote audit, unquote. I'm not going to use the word audit, except in inverted commas, because it really isn't, where you see Republicans having hired a company to go through votes, to second guess, and to apply completely non-scientific techniques in order to test and by so doing, in a sense, indirectly or directly to validate some really crazy notions about how Chinese actors were looking to hack the vote. Are there traces of bamboo? All of these things which really do long-term damage to U.S. democracy to the extent that they create a set of self-reinforcing beliefs among Republicans.
And so these also can work in the reverse, right? I mean, these things could be fixed in that way.
Yes, well, that's the hope. So, and again, I think that our article, like many articles, we're stronger on the diagnosis than on the cure. But one of the things that I think we do want to argue, and this is something which is subtly different from, say, for example, what President Obama said in the clip that you just quoted, is, you know, one argument is that there are these self-equilibrating forces in democracy. That is that when things begin to go bad, that we can expect other forces to counter-react and to make things go good again. And here, you know, sort of maybe you could look at some of the stuff that is happening in New Mexico around the around some of the craziness. And there's an interesting article which just came out in Politico this morning, which suggests that all of this madness doesn't look good to voters, that voters begin to get worried about this, and that so this may be what people like Obama are hoping, that this will create this self-reinforcing flight of many former Republicans away from their party, and that once Republicans realize that they are losing, that they will begin to come back to the table. But the other way you can look at this is to say, okay, well, this is actually much more like a feedback loop, and things are going to get worse and worse and worse unless you try to find specific ways that to try and make them get better. And unless you try to figure out ways to redirect the feedback loop and redirect some of these energies, which are not necessarily in themselves harmful or completely harmful energies. The fact that politicians want to stay in power is when they are prepared to accept democratic decisions. That is what makes them decide to try and do things that voters are interested in them doing. That is what makes them responsive to voters. Suspicion about procedures can also be something which is a useful set of checks, especially in a country like the United States, which of course has had terrible history of disenfranchising Black voters and other classes of voters en masse. All of these things can be redirected, and things have been worse in the past than they are at the moment. U.S. democracy has been in much worse situations before and in living memory. But the only way that you're going to do this is if you start to think specifically and systematically about how to turn these feedback loops, which are going bad, trying to redirect them, trying to create alternative feedback loops to try and make things go better again.
Well, and also I would say the decaying trust in institutions, which then, you know, manifests itself in the way Republicans are chipping away at voting rights throughout the country, upholding the belief in an institution, aka not acting on buttressing or fortifying an institution as there's a degradation throughout the country in a very specific and targeted fashion, that's an action in and of itself, is it not?
Yes, it is. And the other thing I would say is that there is also a worry that we express, albeit not sort of as directly in the papers we might have, that people are going to start to want to push away from democracy, that we're going to see a lot of elite opinion saying, well, if democracy can produce this kind of stuff, if democracy is producing people like Donald Trump, people like the Republican Party at the moment, we want less of it. And our intuition is that this is a bad idea, that we want to think about buttressing democracy, as you say, but we also want to think about buttressing democracy in a dynamic sense, because to get back to some of the comments that Sam was making earlier about how Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama were far more vulnerable to these kinds of criticisms and these kinds of crazy conspiracy theories than Joe Biden might be. A lot of this is because people are becoming more directly involved in politics that were largely shut out of the democratic process before. And so really the balancing act we want to try and pull off is to try and make democracy as open as possible to new forces that are necessarily part of the dynamic benefits that democracy provides, while at the same time trying to minimize the likelihood that absolute QAnon craziness is going to predominate and do all of the terrible things that it is doing right now.
So let's go to, some of these, what you talk about in terms of changing the incentives and how one builds trust, sort of, I guess, to sort of reorient these feedback loops. But let me just also ask this, maybe before we enter into that phase of your report. What of the notion that it is going to be exceedingly difficult to, if the idea is that people buy into democracy because there is an opportunity for them to win the election? I'm not just talking about politicians, but I'm talking about, parties, but just, the individuals who make up the parties. They're going to win the election, right? Which ultimately means really they're going to control society from their perspective. If part of this, and part of the reason why I think Barack Obama was so vulnerable and why Hillary Clinton was so vulnerable, is if part of it is a function of a change in the dynamics in society where Black people, people of color, women are gaining more authority in society. They're having more say, not quite equal necessarily, but more than they had before, which necessarily means less, right? I mean, there's only, everybody can talk, but there is, it is in some fashion or another a zero sum game, right? I mean, more people who you welcome into the stage to have a voice, that means that mine is often diminished. Is there a mechanism that can actually convince people that they will not lose that control of society? I mean, do you follow what I'm saying? Like,
I do.
And has that, and I would just couple to that the theory that maybe you're familiar with Bob Altemeyer, who was up in the University of Manitoba, who had done, clinical reports that, 25% of all North Americans are right-wing authoritarians, and that this dynamic and this awareness of this dynamic sort of like heightened those impulses over the years. And then one guy came around, lit the match, and there it is. I mean, so how do you, with the things that you've prescribed, and we'll talk about that, how do you reckon for that possibility that it is like more, that there is no way to convince them that they can get control?
So it depends. And I think that part of it is, do you think about this, as you say, as a zero-sum game? or do you think about it as an expanding game? And here, I think that the temptation has been to, and I would say both on the left and on the right, to portray it in zero-sum game terms, that anything that we do that looks after our own people is to the good, and that anything, and that this necessarily is going to mean that the other people don't get it, and the other people are bad and horrible people, and therefore, and therefore. And that, I think, I think that that is a form of rhetoric and a form of thinking that we have to try and get away from. And I think one way to think about this would be to think, what are the things that you can do if you see a external coalition forming against you, which you believe is going to stop you from doing the things that are necessary and right for democracy? How do you split that coalition? How do you figure out which people on the fringes of that coalition might be persuadable in terms which allow you, and this of course is the difficult art of politics, in terms that allow you to maintain the coalition that you have already created and already brought in? And so I think that in addition, and this is not the kind of stuff that we are talking about in our paper, which is much more about the nuts and bolts of democracy, of trying to figure out rules, of trying to figure out ways to reshape beliefs so that people at least maintain this minimum set of beliefs in the democratic system. The much bigger question which you're pointing to, and which I think Emma in a way indirectly was pointing to as well, is the question of how do you persuade people that they have a sufficient long-term stake in the democratic system, and that they are going to be able to have a reasonable life in this democratic system together with these people who, whether you like them or whether you dislike them, and of course this is the big thing in American politics, is this kind of bifurcation, you're going to have to live with one way or the other, and how do you try and figure out some kind of mutual means of living together, a modus vivendi, to use a obscure Latin term.
So let's talk about that. You get to the some ways of changing the incentives and some ways of building a trust. One of them, you said, in terms of changing the incentive is the For the People Act. Even Joe Manchin perceives that as a partisan play, but you make an argument that it's not.
So I think it depends on what you mean by partisan play. So if you read Manchin's his op-ed where he makes this argument, for him, a partisan play is something that is going to not get the support of the elected representatives of the other side. And I think that is something which, given the current state of U.S. politics, anything that creates any real change is almost certainly not going to get Republican support. That is just a fact of the situation that we're in at the moment, and a fact of the way that the Republican Party is. And Daniel Ziblatt, who is a very well-known writer about democracy, has pointed out on Twitter that if you look back at many of the great voting rights acts or voting rights initiatives of the last 150 years, they did not get bipartisan support either. So this has always been a game in which partisanship has been part and parcel. But there's a difference between getting partisan support for a measure and having a measure that is going to, over the longer term, have partisan consequences. So I think that what you want, and this is, I'm saying this not to try and attract Joe Manchin, because I have no better idea than anybody else of what would get him to sign on, but what you're looking for are efforts that are going to create a less partisan environment over the longer term, in the sense that they will make it more difficult for any party, whether it be Democrats or Republicans, to assert long-term control, long-term dominance over government, even under circumstances where they have lost the favor of voters. Now, there are many ways in which the United States constitutional system makes this difficult, especially at the level of state politics, but there still is quite a lot that you could do. And so the implicit bargain that these forms of legislation are trying to make is, this will disadvantage Republicans, certainly in many places, but we can also think about places like my home state of Maryland, where very clearly the state boundary, the boundaries have been gerrymandered so as to maximize the number of Democratic representatives who will be elected to the House. And so the trade-off then becomes, if we live in a world where none of us are able to do this, we will all be better off. But that is a very different form of nonpartisanship than the kind of definition that Manchin has, which is more or less you need to get the support of the Republican Party. And given that the Republican Party is split, you might say, between a Mitch McConnell faction, which wants to push the rules as far as they can without absolute collapse of the system, and a Trump faction, which is push the rules as far as they can, no matter whether this collapses the system or not, there isn't any plausible compromise that you can see. And you can even see Lisa Murkowski talking about the John Lewis Act, which Manchin has talked about, and saying that she basically believes that this is not going to go through. She is the only Republican who supports it, and that she does not see any very obvious path through which another 9 Republicans can be brought on board.
You also mentioned politicians who supported what took place on the 6th need to be punished in a way that creates a legitimate disincentive for people to follow that behavior. That also seems like an unlikely mechanism. Like, that McConnell has basically said that we have now effectively been able to define any punishment that you mete out by any institution as being partisan. So that would cycle into the sort of like on the problematic side. Ranked choice voting, yeah, it'd be nice. But let's talk about the build the trust and information flow of things, because that seems to me to be like at the very least, like it's not as reliant necessarily on it's more of a bank shot. Let's put it that way than going to Mitch McConnell and say, hey, like, are you on board for punishing the people who supported this thing or are you on board to, you know, pass any type of voting reform? What are the issues involved in building trust? And really what we're talking about in many respects is like social media at this point. What are the issues that are involved and what is tricky about it?
Okay, well, there are a couple of things that are tricky. First of all, that social media is a problem. It isn't as much of the problem as you might think. If you want to look for what is really the big problem, I think it's Fox News. And there is a fantastic book that has been written on this by Yochai Benkler. He's a professor at Harvard, together with 2 colleagues, looking at how it is that Fox News plays this incredibly important role in the social media, the broader social media and media ecosystem of grabbing crazy beliefs from the fringe and elevating them so they become central tenets in the faith that you're supposed to subscribe to as a member of the Republican Party. So I think social media is important, but also we want to think more generally about media structures. And again, part of the problem is that we have a body of jurisprudence and a set of set of laws and a set of legal principles, which make it extremely difficult to tackle these things directly. So one of the things that Bruce and I, and we are not, I should make clear, we are not lawyers, we are not legal scholars, we are not deeply embedded in the communications debates. But one thing that we wonder is, to what extent can you push the responsibility to be factually accurate as far as possible, given existing licensing requirements, so that you are really trying, in a sense, to use the vulnerability of these businesses to libel laws, to very, you know, to saying things that are untrue and actively harmful. You're trying to weaken their possible defenses against that in situations where they very clearly are propagating falsehoods on the airwaves. And here the idea is very clearly, you know, so if you look at how it is that Dominion and these voting companies are now suing them, sort of media companies which propagated falsehoods that directly and visibly damaged their businesses, to what extent can you try and make it a condition of being a public broadcaster, of having access to all of these public goods which are provided by the US government? To what extent can you make this conditional on these businesses having a substantial fact-checking sort of informational accuracy component that would then make them more legally vulnerable in situations where they either had the knowledge internally that they, in fact, were saying things that were factually false, or alternatively, that they sort of tried to figure ways around this so that they short-circuit this, but again, that makes them look bad in court. So this is not a major fix, but I think we're in the world, as you say, of bank shots. We're in the world of trying to figure out what kinds of things can we do, given where we are, to really, to try and change things around the edges in the hope that might have larger consequences going forward.
I know you also raised antitrust, and it seems to me that, you know, when we talk about, and I am all for tort actions and think that they have a very important role. But ultimately, when we say legal, what we really mean is financial, right? Yeah. I mean, the it's not that someone is going to, Fox is going to feel bad that they were marked with a scarlet letter of lying about Dominion. They don't care about that at all. I mean, they've defended Tucker Carlson in court as saying nobody takes him seriously. Nobody takes him seriously in that way. That's not the way it's supposed to work. They're afraid of losing money. And so it seems to me that antitrust or even, and I'm really looking at what like is the most has the most potential of actually happening. Antitrust, it seems to me, could very well diminish the profitability of a lot of these entities. There's half a dozen baby foxes out there now. As cord cutting gets more ubiquitous, I mean, all of this feeds itself. But if there's less money to be made by individual companies because they are monopolies or because they are dominating a space in some way, it seems to me it's the most largest potential incentive or disincentive, which is there's just not enough money involved in it to continue to push these things.
That's plausibly right, although we don't have nearly as much analysis as we would like of what the specific consequences are of particular antitrust actions. One other thing that I think is worth paying attention to that US people don't pay enough attention to is the role of antitrust in the European Union, where you really are seeing a revolution in thinking about antitrust and in bringing it together with a lot of broader principles about information flows, about ensuring that these information flows are not politically harmful, about privacy, all of these things becoming principles which get brought together with the standard antitrust notions of how it is that you try to make markets work efficiently and well. And this could have consequences maybe indirect for the ways in which US lawyers and some judges at least think about it, but it also could have direct consequences for major global social media companies such as Facebook, such as YouTube, that may find themselves on the wrong end of European Union antitrust actions, which could have substantial consequences for their profitability if they do not clear up their act. And this could, again, depending upon the precise form that those judgments take, this could have substantial implications for their actions within the United States as well.
Well, hope springs eternal, I guess, that things work out that way in Europe, and maybe we can adopt some of those policies. Professor Henry Farrell, the report is entitled Rechanneling Beliefs, How Information Flows Hinder or Help American Democracy. We will put a link to that report. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
And thank you so much, Sam and Emma. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back in just a minute to wrap things up. So there you have it. I don't, I'm a little concerned. It is becoming increasingly clear that Joe Manchin is not going to help in the project, at least of the For the People Act. There may be enough voting rights reforms embedded in the John Lewis voting bill. Still unclear whether Joe Manchin will take a step to reform the filibuster, but I don't know. I mean,
well, I'm incredibly discouraged by the fact that we have a president who has a very similar mindset to Obama in terms of just passively approaching the restoration of our institutions and democracy in and of itself by giving Republicans way too much credence. It's like this inside baseball kind of shaking hands, senatorial nonsense, and not really seeing the Republicans for the monsters that they are. And that creates a very toxic, scary situation. Like a lot of the reforms that were discussed by Henry Farrell there, I don't see there being any movement on in the near future.
Certainly not unless, you know, the leaders of the parties sort of acknowledge the severity of the problem. I mean, that's we're in this sort of like paradox where there is on one hand, there's rhetoric that we are in this severe crisis of democracy. That certainly the leadership of the Democratic Party will articulate. But then at other moments, they're not pointing to what has driven us into that crisis and making it clear, but maybe that changes in the coming days and weeks ahead. I guess we'll see. I can understand the theory that it's hard to go backwards. It's hard to do a takesy backsies on that. And so maybe you wait until the last minute, but it sort of feels like we're pretty close to that last minute. We are certainly at the last minute of our program. For those of you who watch us on Peacock, and for those of you who do, we will say goodbye and see you tomorrow. And then for those of you who are hanging around for the fun half, see you now. Naomi Kantz is going to join us in just moments, minutes, seconds. Good time for me to remind you that it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show, gets you guests like Henry Farrell, for instance. Tomorrow, who do we have on the program tomorrow, Brendan?
We have John B. Judas.
John B. Judas. And then I think we have Astra Taylor on Thursday. So it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie. Check that out. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Don't forget to check out our Discord, majoritydiscord.com. Nomi, what's happening on your show today at 3 p.m.?
We have our panel is Akela Lacey and Simon Rode. And before that, we have Richard Wolff.
Oh, exciting.
So it's a fun show.
Big day today. And that's
I guess
3,
so.
3 p.m. That sounds like
3 p.m. right after this show on youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow and twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show. I did not create that.
Matt_Leck. What is happening in the Matt_Leckian underscore?
Well, there's no underscore. It's just MATTLECH on all the social media, so don't get confused, folks. But last night, we did a debate watch. Leo Panish debated two capitalists, a Tory and Ayn Rand Institute guy, and it was very infuriating, but Panish is very smart. So that was for patrons. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get access to that. And this afternoon, David Griscom is going to be doing a live stream. He's been seeing that big money is corrupting democracy discourses back again. So he's going to be talking about why it's not just money in politics, but capitalism generally. That is a threat to democracy. So that's this afternoon. at the Left Reckoning YouTube channel, which more and more people are subscribing to.
I hear lots of things. It's really getting
hearing big. Many things. Hearing many it's very, very popular.
All
not
right.
as big as me, though.
We will take a quick break and be back in just a moment.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
What, who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday! Birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
What?
Come on.
What?
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.